Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We want to welcome this morning students who are here with the Court with Class program. This is a program that the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court sponsor. We invite students from high schools around the state to come, listen to an oral argument, and meet with a justice at noon. And we have with us students from Franklin High School. Would they stand, please? Well, welcome. You may be seated. And we have students from Jubilee Christian School. Would they stand, please? Welcome to you also. And we have Zoe Kruenberg from Whitefish Bay High School, who's decided to do her own Court with Class today. If she would stand, Zoe. Good, we welcome you. The students have gotten materials about the case today, and as I said, we'll meet with the justice. So now let me introduce the justices. I'll start on my far right with Justice Prosser, and he is the justice with whom you all will meet at noon, and anyone in the courtroom who is not part of the program is also invited to attend. Seated next to Justice Prosser is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With the introductions made, we'll proceed to call the first case this morning, 01-1969-CR, State v. Brian Seifeld. Arguing for the State of Wisconsin is Michael R. Kloss, Assistant Attorney General.
Good morning, Justices. If it pleases the court, this case is before court this morning on a petition for review filed by the state from an adverse decision of the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals ruled that the trial court had abused its discretion when it had granted a mistrial after finding, first, that defense counsel had violated a pretrial order by mentioning a number of outstanding warrants against a state witness during defense counsel's opening statement to the jury. The trial court also, in an exercise of its discretion, found that the jury had been tainted by the remarks made by defense counsel, and that the only reasonable alternative in the trial court's view was to grant the state's motion for a mistrial. Now, on appeal, the Court of Appeals applied what it believed was the appropriate standard of review of the trial court's discretionary motion on mistrial. The Court of Appeals ruled that since the state had made the motion for a mistrial during opening statements to the jury, and the defense had not consented to the mistrial, the appropriate standard of review was strict scrutiny. In reaching its decision, the Court of Appeals relied upon this court's decision in State v. Bartles, which I think is probably the primary subject of focus this morning in terms of the state's request for review. As the state pointed out in its petition for review and in its Supreme Court brief, the primary reason a petition for review was filed by the state is a concern as to what should be the appropriate standard of appellate review when a trial court makes or when a trial court grants a motion for mistrial on the motion of the prosecutor. The state argues in its brief and to the court this morning that there is ambiguous language in the Barthels decision, which the Court of Appeals relied upon, which is inconsistent with the precise holding of the United States Supreme Court in Arizona versus Washington. I believe it's important that we focus on that specific language in the Barthels decision, because this is the precise language which the Court of Appeals relied upon in its decision. Now, this Court wrote in Barthels, quote, "If the defendant has requested or consented to a mistrial, the Court may reasonably infer that the defendant, whether for tactical or strategic reasons, has waived his right to be free of double jeopardy. In such situations, the trial judge's decision on mistrial is entitled to great deference."
Right. Let me ask you then, counsel, in understanding Arizona, which I agree with you, is the seminal case. Barthels, of course, is a different type of case.
It is.
Than Arizona versus Washington and the State versus Seafield case. But just looking at this case and having been a trial judge for a number of years, when in the record they talk about the pretrial order, and it's my understanding that nowhere was that pretrial order ever written down. I think there's perhaps a concession of everyone that there was a pretrial order, but there wasn't really an order that we as a reviewing court can go back and look at. Is that correct? Is that correct?
There is no written order.
Okay. So there's an assumption that basically what it was, as Judge Wienke talked about, was, look, anything coming in dealing with other acts, and we're talking about the 15 warrants, and that he had told defense counsel Carroll, that you can't do that. And then, as the record shows, and this is the only record we have, is that I think defense counsel's or the prosecution said about an hour and 15 minutes later, or hour and 40, you went out and this was violated, and that's why I moved for a mistrial. And all the judge said here, yeah, he understood, he has tried many cases, and I was kind of confused because he said, you know, the opening statement should be a neutral statement. And I don't know, I don't think it should be a neutral statement. If the judge has a statement, it should be neutral, but I think an opening statement by the prosecution or the defense basically says, this is the deal, this is what I intend to show, or this is, defense counsel would be saying, look, this is going to be our argument, and this is what we intend to show. So that the violation of the judge's pretrial order was never written, and as I understand it, it was a very quick colloquy after that that the judge said, well, look, I can't give a curative instruction. There's nothing I can do. The jury is tainted. But don't you think there should have been something more extensive than what was simply mistrial and I can't do anything about it? There was that's what struck me as a little different than perhaps the Arizona versus Washington, which sets forth the deferential standard that you're asking that this Court use.
That's correct. I guess in response to your questions, first of all, I would agree the opening statement by counsel does not necessarily have to be neutral. It can argue in some respects the facts and the position that both parties intend to present to the jury. With respect to the second question, I think the trial court did, in explaining its reasons, indicate that there had been a meeting immediately before trial between counsel and the trial court, and that the trial court, and there had been discussion of other acts evidence, perhaps discussion of these specific warrants that were outstanding against the defense witness, and that the trial court had specifically directed the parties that there should be no mention of this evidence without a prior ruling on admissibility by the trial court. So now I agree with the judge's or justice's characterization of the record. We do not have a written order that was entered, but we do have a characterization and a description of what occurred by the trial court and no dispute among the parties. And as I understand the basis for the Court of Appeals decision, it assumes that there was a specific order entered by the trial court directing the parties not to mention other acts evidence or other related evidence without a prior ruling by the trial court, and that defense counsel deliberately went out after the meeting in chambers for his own purposes and violated that order. So while I would agree it would have been preferable if a more extensive record had been made and was available to the court, I don't agree, but I would submit that based on the premise for the Court of Appeals ruling, that they're assuming that that's true, that that is what the record reflects, and that is what happened, I think the court can act on that basis in considering what the appropriate standard of review for the appellate court in reviewing the decision made by the trial court granting a mistrial in this case.
Mr. Close?
Yes.
In the Court of Appeals opinion on page 125 in your appendix, this sentence appears. Here we found no basis for concluding that the state would have been denied a fair proceeding. The jury heard only information concerning evidence that Seifelt would have been constitutionally entitled to present in his defense. Do you agree with any or all of that sentence? Or do you disagree with any or all?
Okay. I would say I disagree with the characterization made there by the Court of Appeals. Now,
what characterization?
That all of this evidence would have been admissible in exactly the form in which it was presented by the defense counsel in opening argument to the jury without any limitations on scope, presentation,
well,
and so
said,
forth by the
trial
court.
He said that the offending words were, she's got 15 warrants out, right?
I think the offending words were probably, she has 15 warrants out for bad checks.
Or for bad checks, okay.
Right.
Are you saying that that would not have been allowed in?
Well, you know,
you seem to say in your brief that it would have been.
The defense argued in the context of the opening statement and the argument to the trial court, and this is the position the Court of Appeals taken, is that this evidence is admissible to show motive. And how is what motive and what motive is relevant here? Well, the evidence is the defendant and his girlfriend were apprehended by the police or stopped by the police who had an outstanding warrant for them. And as the police officers approached, they remained in the car, refused to get out. The police officer said, the defendant signaled Michelle Bart, the girlfriend who was driving the car, pushed her foot in the accelerator, they took off, and there was a high-speed chase. The theory of the defense was, well, it was Michelle Bard who decided to flee and made that decision, not the defendant. And the reason was, is because, told the jury, there's 15 outstanding warrants against her for bad checks. Now, would this be admissible? It's arguably relevant. It's not very probative in this context. The defendant and his girlfriend were sitting there with the police standing outside with a revolver, and their car was full of drugs and other drug paraphernalia stuff.
Mr. Clark,
but it was relevant.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out here how the jury was tainted, because that's apparently what the trial court believed. I mean, did the trial counsel disobey a court order? Probably. Could he have been sanctioned, or should he have been sanctioned? Yes. Was he a bad boy? Yes. But how was the jury tainted so as to essentially, well, not essentially, but to say we got to start all over again?
As I look at
the... Where's the violation?
Okay. I think what the violation did, I mean, the trial court has a responsibility and obligation in the admission of evidence, whether it's other acts evidence, impeachment evidence, credibility evidence, to control the scope and admissibility of the evidence. Now, if you look at the record and the comments made by the parties, it appears that the prosecutor says, we don't dispute there's 15 warrants. But these were ordinance violations, forfeitures. And what my defense counsel just throwing this information at the jury that there's 15 outstanding warrants, I'm going to have to defend on a collateral issue. That we're not talking about additional criminal charges against Michelle Bart that might have provided motive. These are simple ordinance violations.
Well, if we start off with the underlying premise, which you seem to agree with, that this evidence was going to come in, then the prosecutor should have known he was going to have to defend against that.
Well, I think the position the State took in the brief is we understand the argument that's made by the defendant that this is motive evidence. It may have been admissible, but the trial court certainly had, first of all, or should have had, first of all, an opportunity to weigh. Maybe the probative value of this evidence was outweighed by prejudice to the State. Prejudice of having to defend on a collateral issue, evidence that had marginal probative value in terms of supporting the theory of defense. The trial court was never given that opportunity. So that was the first thing.
Mr.
Yes.
So what? Let's say that at the appropriate time the ruling was made to exclude this evidence. What's the taint? The defense counsel is left out there hanging, having asserted a fact that he doesn't have any evidence for in the record.
I think the taint would be that in my opinion, in the minds of the jury, this would raise a serious question about Michelle Bart's credibility. Because
it's going to be impeached with 6 criminal convictions, wasn't she?
And now an additional 15 criminal warrants.
Well, when the testimony came in that she had been convicted for 6 crimes and that was admissible or going to be admissible under 906.09.
It was.
It hardly seems to make matters worse that there was a reference, perhaps inappropriate under 904.03, in opening statement to the existence of warrants, not convictions. Do you understand the distinction?
I understand your point of view. I guess I don't agree with it. I think that is piling on. That could be prejudicial to the State. No reason for that type of misconduct by defense counsel in opening statement to the jury. And if you read the record, it's clear that both the prosecutor and the trial court were very upset by what had occurred and were convinced that there was a possibility of a jury taint in this case and that the appropriate remedy was mistrial at this early point in the proceedings.
You're not arguing that this was inadmissible other acts evidence under 904.04 sub 2?
No.
And you're not arguing that this was inadmissible impeachment evidence under 906.09?
For prior convictions, no.
Okay. So the only basis for exclusion of this evidence would have been the probative prejudicial balancing under 904.
Right. In my opinion, reading the record and the arguments made, although, the parties really didn't focus on that. They were all over the place in terms of describing the evidence. I think it was impeachment evidence. Yes.
Counsel, there was a full trial in this case. What happened to this evidence in the full trial? What happened to the 15 warrants in the full trial?
Well, if you look at the argument by the prosecutor at the first trial, after his motion for mistrial was made, he was concerned, and I don't know exactly the rationale here, but he was concerned that the defense counsel was trying to dissuade Michelle Bart from testifying. What happened, I do not know. But Michelle Bart was not a witness at the second trial. So there was no issue on the issue of the 15 outstanding warrants. The case proceeded to trial without her testimony, and the defendant was convicted.
Counsel, I just want to follow up on Justice Sykes' question.
Yes.
Because it has to do with the tainting. It has to do with the fact that the judge said that there was no curative instruction. Now, when I look at Arizona versus Washington, they talk about an overriding interest in the even-handed administration of justice requires that we accord the highest degree of respect to the trial judge's evaluation of the likelihood that the impartiality of one or more of the jurors may have been affected by the improper conduct. Now, that is arguing basically for a deferential standard. The difficulty, I think, that in what Justice Sykes goes to is that here the trial judge, in a very short time, you know, because we're assuming, as you say, and the Court of Appeals conceded that the be as it may, a court may not declare a mistrial simply because the order was violated. The court, that's what they're saying, and they assume that there was blatant violation of a pretrial order. I think what we're I'm struggling with is that the judge, perhaps in his recitation, should have said, as discussed here, this was the taint. This is what would have happened. This is what I was thinking of. This is why I think that the jurors could not properly or were tainted in this, and why I cannot give a curative instruction. We only have such a short colloquy here that it, as you can see by some of the questions we're asking, well, just would the evidence come in? What was this taint? And we're debating that now. I don't really argue, you know, whether it should be deferential. The problem is that the judge didn't lay it out, as I think even in the Arizona case, it took, thought about there was at least some, there was more on the record, so to speak. I really want to be critical of the judge because I know what you get the impression here behind the scenes. There was a lot of stuff going on, and I think he was very perturbed about what took place, as the Court of Appeals does mention.
Well, I agree with the substance of your comments, and one of the reasons why, in order to try to sustain the trial court's decision, I'm trying to suggest some rationale in terms of jury taint and the judge's position. I would have been in a much better position if the judge had spent more time placing on the record the basis for its decision. But what the State's been concerned with here, and I think it's clear in our brief and in our petition, is the standard of review.
Well, counsel, let's
in this
get
case.
To that.
Yes.
Because whether or not this case fits within that standard is, of course, important to Mr. Seifeld and
absolutely
to the State. But my understanding is you really are concerned about the substance of a published Court of Appeals decision.
That's correct.
Just a standard. So I would like you to tell us, one, what you think is the correct standard under Arizona v. Washington, whether you think that standard was different in Barthels, or whether you think the Court of Appeals just misinterpreted Barthels.
In response, Your Justice.
Is that the issue you want to talk about?
That is the issue.
Okay.
We would
Let's
like
talk.
To rest. Well, I quoted on page 11 and 12 of our brief the language from Washington versus Arizona, which I believe applies the correct standard for when strict scrutiny is the appropriate standard
now,
on review.
Strict scrutiny doesn't mean the equal protection strict scrutiny, does it?
It does not.
It has a special meaning here as to how much deference you give to the trial court. Isn't that right?
I would construe that in this context to be analogous to de novo review, where there isn't any particular deference given to the trial court's discretionary decision, and the court's going to pretty much take a look at the record, the facts, and the decision to make its own evaluation.
Arizona v. Washington says you have different standards, different reviews of the trial court, right? You got
correct
heavy deference, great deference, and you got less deference,
correct,
depending upon who made the motion and what happened at the trial.
Those are all relevant factors.
Yes. Okay. So what is the greatest deference given? What facts?
I would imagine the greatest deference would be in the context where the motion is made by defense counsel or consented to by defense counsel, because, as this Court pointed out in Bartels, that's a situation where, for strategic or tactical reasons, the Court can fairly conclude that the defense has waived its double jeopardy claim. I suppose it would be analogous to the situation where the defendant moves for a new trial after a judgment's been entered. Court can fairly conclude he's waived.
Okay. So that's great deference?
Right.
Great deference to a finding of manifest necessity, isn't it?
In that context, I don't know if it's manifest necessity. I think that is used only in the context of a state request or a prosecutorial request.
All right.
I don't even know if the great deference, the Court talks about great deference. It just seems to me what it is, it's a finding by the Court that the defense has waived its double jeopardy claim.
Okay.
So that's it. That answers the question.
Let's move on to the next fact situation.
Okay. The next fact situation, in my opinion, would be a situation where the prosecution makes a motion for a mistrial, but there is no misconduct, no finding of recklessness, no finding that there is a design by the state to try to gain a tactical advantage. And on that, I point specifically to the language in Washington versus Arizona, which I quote on page 11 and 12. And I think that that statement is fairly supported by that specific language. I guess which leads us then to your, I think, second question, Your Honor, about Barthel's decision. In Barthel's, this Court applied a strict scrutiny standard. But on the facts of that case, that was appropriate under Washington versus Arizona, because in Barthel's, this Court found that the prosecutor had recklessly gone to trial without securing the presence of a critical witness, and then at the end of his case, moved for a mistrial. This Court found that reckless. Under Washington versus Arizona, I think the strict scrutiny standard is appropriate, because here the state is doing something deliberately to prejudice the defense and provoke a mistrial.
They don't call it strict scrutiny. I think they call it searching scrutiny.
In Barthel's?
In Barthel's.
Okay. That very well may be true.
And they also then say, we therefore review the decision of the circuit court with marked strictness.
This is all, I think, analogous language trying to identify.
Do you find any of that contrary to Arizona v. Washington?
The language which I find ambiguous
is
the language which I quote from Barthel's on page 10.
Okay. Where is it in the Barthel's opinion?
It is on, let's see.
184.
Barthel's, page 184. It's in the paragraph that begins the standard by which this Court reviews.
What I'm looking at.
Right. It's in my brief at page 10.
It says, if the defendant has requested or consented, then it goes, if, however, the prosecutor requests the mistrial or the judge determines that the defendant's request was occasioned by prosecutorial overreaching or laxness, then this Court gives stricter and more searching scrutiny to the judge's decision to grant a trial. The most stringent scrutiny is afforded when the basis for the mistrial is the unavailability of critical prosecution evidence, quoting Arizona.
Correct.
So what's the...
The ambiguity I find, and I think this is what the Court of Appeals attached itself to, is that it appears at the beginning there when the Court wrote, if, however, the prosecutor requests the mistrial, that alone provides a basis for applying the strict scrutiny standard. Because it's, if the prosecutor requests the mistrial or the Court determines there's some misconduct or recklessness on the part of the prosecution, these are two independent and parallel bases for applying strict scrutiny. I think, although this isn't the basis for the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court's decision in Barthel's, I think the ambiguity of that language needs to be clarified and harmonize with the rule on strict scrutiny that's elaborated and enunciated by the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington versus Arizona versus Washington.
So what language from Arizona do you suggest, and where is it in the Arizona opinion?
Okay, at page 11 and 12 of the state's brief.
Right.
It's from Arizona versus Washington, 434 U.S., at page 508.
Okay.
The court writes, the strictest scrutiny is appropriate when the basis for the mistrial is the unavailability of a critical prosecution evidence, or when there is reason to believe that the prosecutor is using the superior resources of the state to harass or to achieve a tactical advantage over the accused. In those cases, the strict scrutiny or searching scrutiny standard is appropriate.
What's the scrutiny in this case?
In the case before the court, I think the appropriate standard is based on the parallel Washington versus Arizona versus Washington deferential review.
Well, how deferential? That's the whole point of Arizona v. Washington, is that there's a range of deference.
Well,
from great to strict.
Well,
scrutiny.
I don't think strict scrutiny encompasses deferential review.
No, it doesn't.
So what we're talking about, whether you care to...
Are there only two? Great deference and strict scrutiny.
I thought about that question, Your Honor. I can't reasonably think of an intermediate stage. Perhaps if a different set of facts come before the court, it'll become apparent. But I think there's just great deference and strict scrutiny.
Chief, if I may, a follow-up question. I'll save it for your rebuttal. That's fine.
Okay. I do notice my time has expired here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Lang.
May it please the Court. Don Lang, appearing on behalf of Brian Seifelt, the original appellant in this case. It's our position, of course, that the Court of Appeals correctly concluded that a second trial was inappropriate in this case under double jeopardy because there wasn't sufficient manifest necessity to warrant a mistrial in the first trial. And frankly, I don't think in this particular fact situation it really matters what kind of standard of review is applied, that under these facts the trial court simply did exercise sound discretion, that in fact the decision to grant a mistrial was predicated on a misunderstanding of some evidentiary questions, partly induced by the DA argument.
So you don't care which the court uses?
Oh, I care very much, and I hope to devote most of my time to discussing the standard. But I just think under these facts, even an abuse of discretion standard isn't satisfied, that a view of this record can't support a finding of manifest necessity.
Well, why shouldn't we use a deferential in this case or in any other case when facts similar to this are what brought about the request for a mistrial?
Deferential standard of review, quite frankly, is inadequate to protect the constitutional right at stake.
But what about
so consequently, we need some objective criteria to ascertain whether there is manifest necessity or not.
What about the Arizona case? It seems to me, and I read this language to your opposing counsel, we're talking about the even-handedness of administration of justice. And so both sides, the state people, they're entitled to a fair trial, as is the defendant. And so if you have a defendant whose counsel makes something that is, in this case, let's say there was something the court could look back at and say, well, yes, the judge laid this out very clearly. You're saying in all cases that you should not use a deferential standard because the prosecution moved for a mistrial?
Well, let me clarify, because I think I share slightly the problem counsel for the state has, and that is it's hard to define this in a broad brushstroke because there are so many variables that occur in terms of double jeopardy law. So the standard that's applied depends on the circumstances.
Well, and we normally follow, at least
Arizona versus Washington would be the, quote, seminal case. We follow the federal double jeopardy in the state of Wisconsin as far as what standard we would use. You know, we have Barthels, but Barthels clearly, do you think Barthels is clearly the case? It was certainly a different circumstance than we have here.
It's different circumstances. I don't think it's inconsistent with Arizona versus Washington. It may use slightly different terminology to describe the same thing, but it's essentially in tune with Arizona versus Washington. In terms of this particular fact situation compared to the opening statement in Arizona versus Washington, we would have a much closer case or scenario if counsel for the defense had gotten up and said, well, you know, they have a lot of nerve bringing a drug prosecution here because I know the prosecutors in the DA's office over in Fond du Lac snort cocaine themselves. Clearly, there's no way that that kind of remark could be admissible, and it's highly prejudicial, but that's not the scenario we had. One of the striking things about the case here is the judge in Arizona versus Washington took time to allow defense to go research to try to come up with some rationale for the remarks he made.
Sure, I understand.
And the court operated under the assumption that what he said was inappropriate under any circumstance, that there was no legal basis upon which this kind of assertion could be made.
So if there hadn't been 15 warrants, let's say that was just fictitious, would your answer be the same then? You know, we're talking about whether these are misdemeanor, felony, whatever, ordinance violation, but it wouldn't have to be as egregious as if the judge had and laid out clearly what tainted the jury and why he could not give a curative instruction. Talking about a
deferential standard. Well, that's one of the difficulties here is he doesn't explain why, when he never addresses defense counsel's claim that this goes
I understand device. That. I mean, that's your argument. But I'm just saying, when would or whenever could this court use a deferential standard? You're saying you don't think we could.
My guess, here I'm going to back up a step. There's a great deal of deference afforded to some decisions made by the judge. In the hung jury context, we afford great deference to the decision because the judge is in the position to see the jurors, know how tired they are, know what they've gone through. And so we're going to defer to his judgment about how to apply when to grant a mistrial. Now, underlying that decision, however, there's sort of an undisputed premise that we all accept, and that is that the defendant and state both are entitled to a jury who can make a fair decision. And the whole nature of a hung jury decision is that that's impossible because of fatigue or the circumstances. We let judges make decisions, I would think, in circumstances where there's a snowstorm, like there is out east now, and people can't get to the courthouse for a couple days and the trial's disrupted. And there's a point at which the judge in its administrative duties has to decide, can we really go on with this trial? Can this jury decide it fairly? Could it be exposed to information while the case is pending? That kind of assessment strikes me as one that we defer greatly to. If there's been a contact with a juror and the judge tries to make an assessment of bias, that determination of bias, which precludes continuing the jury, is one that we would defer to. One of the difficulties with Arizona versus Washington and trying to apply it is it seems to apply kind of issues of fact, issues of a law analysis, but it doesn't use those terms to describe it. And so, in this case, there's a discussion by the court that we'll defer to this assessment of prejudice or bias because the judge can see the response of the jury, can see how they react, and we'll give deference to that kind of decision. But the court goes on to say that doesn't end the inquiry. We still have to balance in the defendant's right to double jeopardy protection. And part of our assessment, then, is how does the judge go about taking this right to double jeopardy protection into consideration. Anytime there's a mistrial granted, the defendant loses his right to have this jury decide the case. Anytime there's a mistrial granted, the defendant is forced to endure a second trial. Double jeopardy protects that. The need for an objective standard is to secure that right. In the hung jury context, the legal premise underlying the hung jury is that the jury can't be fair, and the judge is in the best position to assess the facts related to that.
Yeah, I understand the hung jury. It's this beginning. This is the beginning of a trial of several days, a week, whatever. And there is a statement that the judge assumes is going to taint or prejudice the jury. What I'm getting at is that the example, because this we're writing for, you know, a lot of other cases, and the conduct of counsel, not only the prosecutor but defense counsel. So if you come in with a decided advantage, either side, prosecutor or defense counsel, and the judge can give a curative instruction, but he's very concerned about it. And so all through the trial, there has been this, it's not been a playing field level. So the judge perceives that this is the earliest stage. And that's what I'm getting at, is that you give this example of Final Act County, but certainly between that and some lesser offense, there has to be giving a judge who is there seeing this and giving time to counsel to respond. But I'm talking about the standard itself. The Chief Justice asked about the, you know, the standard set out in Arizona in strict scrutiny, deferential, and what's wrong with this court saying, well, deferential is appropriate, and these are the cases we would be taking a look at.
It strikes me, once you, to protect the constitutional interest at stake, you have to have independent, stricter scrutiny. We may call that de novo review. In fact, some courts characterize this decision as a question of law. In the midst of this question of law, there will be, because of the variety of circumstances, some factual findings that are involved. Even in the Bartels scenario, this court indicated it will defer to the trial judge's assessment about the ability of the state to get the witness there, their knowledge of the unavailability of the witness, those types of facts that occurred in the courtroom. But in terms of the application of the constitutional standard, there is an element of de novo review that's going on here. We call it a stricter scrutiny. Arizona calls it determining whether sound discretion was exercised. Some courts refer to it as scrupulously examining the constitutional interest at stake. But it really is sort of a de novo review, ultimately.
Counsel, if I understand the state's argument, what it is objecting to in Bartels is this clause. If, however, the prosecutor requests the mistrial, then this court gives stricter or more searching scrutiny to the judge's decision to grant a mistrial. State, I think, is objecting to the concept that every time the state requests mistrial, you got to have more stringent scrutiny. They think that the state is arguing not always. Sometimes yes, sometimes no, but not always. And that Bartels would seem to say that every time the prosecutor requests the mistrial. Now, do you think every time the prosecutor requests a mistrial, you have to have stringent scrutiny?
Yes, yes. Within the context of that, there will be matters to which you defer to because the judge was able to make findings of fact. But as to the ultimate standard, always stringent scrutiny. I should say as a footnote here, the vast majority of mistrials that occur are defense requests. And frankly, those aren't even on the double jeopardy table. When the defendant chooses to terminate his trial, double jeopardy is just not really an issue at all. So in terms
there's
of
there's a waiver of that constitutional right?
What's that?
Why? Because there's a waiver?
Yeah, he has made a tactical choice to forego having his trial completed by this jury. And
was there any misconduct on the part of the assistant district attorney here, or the district attorney, whoever it was? Misconduct or overreaching or something bad about what the district attorney did?
Well, here's a concern I have. One is he was just wrong on the law. His perception that this evidence couldn't come in, I think, was just, as a matter of law, incorrect. A second concern, and here's the problem in terms of trying to add a gloss of misconduct or overreaching, is how do we know ever what the motivation was behind the prosecutor asking for the mistrial? I mean, we just can't know. Did he sense that Ms. Bartels testimony was going to fall apart? Did he fail to anticipate that she could be impeached? We just don't know. And, you know, did he really want to go for the weekend and his flight was Friday and he was concerned the trial would carry too long? I mean, there's a multitude of reasons here. And to have some apparatus where the defense has to show improper motive, I think, is misguided and inadequate to protect the defense.
If there is no difference for the standard of deference that we show when the prosecution is acting completely honorably versus when the prosecution is reacting to really serious misconduct by defense counsel, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me as a rule. Isn't that sort of inviting misconduct by defense counsel?
I guess you actually raised a couple of questions here. In Arizona versus Washington, they refer to the fact that defendant's right to double jeopardy protections no less violated if the motive's improper by the state or not. Now, in terms of what the state does in response to defense counsel's improper conduct, there are sanctions that can be taken against counsel. If there are points to which counsel's conduct becomes so prejudicial to the case itself, certainly a mistrial is warranted. This was not such a situation. I mean, the record's unfortunately ambiguous. At best, it looks like, from my reading of the record, is there was a general reference to other acts evidence before trial, and the court says don't talk about any of that until we've ruled on it. And then counsel makes his remark.
If the trial judge had laid out, I think, one of the why he thought, and he or she thought, that the jury would be tainted, and what went on in the voir dire, and et cetera, you're saying it never could be in this case because the evidence here would eventually come in under the and that because the Court of Appeals indicated that, and I think Justice Babbage referred to that, but the court clearly says, you know, that we assume that counsel blatantly violated a pretrial order. That's what the Court of Appeals said, prohibiting any mention of other crimes or acts until the court had had a chance to decide that. Now, had the judge said all that then, and had he said the reason this, and the reason I feel that the jury is tainted, your position, as I understand it, and may be accurate, is that this would never have been, should never have been done. No mistrial would have been granted here. Regardless.
Not on this record, no. That if there was some, like, fine-tuning problem, curative instruction ought to have been able to.
Yeah, but that's what I'm getting at, and I think Justice Prosser is asking, that there are situations where just a little twist here and there, that at this stage, and I know that the jeopardy, once the jury has been seated, that's when the defense, of course, or when the defendant is entitled to that particular jury. But if there is an egregious conduct, what is to stop it then?
Well, let me offer a couple of hypotheticals, which I think there are scenarios certainly where a mistrial would be appropriate. Let's assume they had a pretrial conference, and let's assume Ms. Bart had previously caused the death of her child 5 years ago or something. And the judge says, no matter what happens, nobody mentions the death of this child. And the prosecutor, or defense counsel, gets up during his opening statement and says, well, and you're going to hear from Ms. Bart, and no kind of person she is, she killed her child 5 years ago. I mean, the magnitude of the information, the fact it's not admissible, would warrant a mistrial in that context. Does it warrant a mistrial because of the misconduct of counsel? No, it warrants a mistrial because of the substance of the evidence. Second scenario, throughout the course of the trial, the judge is telling counsel not to do something and he keeps doing it. There may be an impact because of his disregard of the court's authority where it disrupts the trial to a point that the trial itself is being tainted.
I guess what I'm
where misconduct can influence the trial. But
I guess what I'm getting at, where there has been a series of motions in limine on the record and the judge has ruled a certain way, and counsel in his opening statements knows those rulings. Now, those rulings may be right or wrong.
But the counsel knows those rulings. And there is a opening statement that might even say, despite what the judge may say, well, I won't say that. Anyway, but goes into that, it would seem to me that the level playing field we're talking about would not exist throughout that entire trial. And so the expectation you have is that, well, if it possibly could have come in, then we're going to have a different, I don't want to use goose and gander, but I will say you have a different, you attach a different level of scrutiny to one side of the trial than you do to the other. And that's the point.
Well,
so you don't have that level playing field that is presupposed in Arizona versus Washington.
Well, in all due respect, I disagree with the premise that there's a level playing field because the defendant, not the government, has a double jeopardy protection. So the court sort of recognizes that when it says, well, we'll defer to the trial judge's ability to assess bias or prejudice upon the jury, but that doesn't end the inquiry. You still have to then compensate or take into consideration the defendant's right to have this tribunal decide the case. And before we interfere with that, we have to do something more. We have to consider alternatives. And I think, which several courts have done, is they basically used what transpired in Arizona versus Washington as sort of the model of what a trial judge ought to do when he's confronted with a situation where some prejudice has occurred.
And they talk about the integrity of the trial, and they talk about the overriding interest in the even-handed administration of justice in Arizona. And that's what I'm talking about or referring to you is when we talk about the standard this court is going to use.
Yeah, I guess I appreciate it. I disagree in terms of what interest is the court requiring you, the trial judge, to protect, and that is the double jeopardy interest. What interest is the reviewing court protecting? It's assuring that the double jeopardy interest was scrupulously honored by the trial judge.
Counsel, I want to continue that discussion on the standard and return back to both cases, Barthels and Arizona versus Washington. You indicate that you think that whenever the prosecutor requests a mistrial, that the strictest scrutiny is to be applied. Did I understand you correctly?
Well, the strictest, not the strictest, strict, or serious. The terminology here gets sort of confusing. It's essentially a de novo review. You have to determine, legally, did this make sense under the circumstance?
Okay.
And when the state witness is unavailable, like in Barthels, we're going to use very, very strict scrutiny because that's something the government could manipulate oh so easily.
I'm going to use your terms then, de novo review, and I suppose the other is deferential, but what degree of deference we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. I want to go to the Barthels quote that the state has problems with. That's on page 184 of the Barthels case, and we've focused on it previously. If, however, the prosecutor requests the mistrial or the judge determines that the defendant's request was occasioned, etc. Now, the state says the problem I have with that is that it just says if the prosecutor requests a mistrial, that in and of itself is sufficient to get this de novo review. And the state is saying, that's not the language of Arizona versus Washington. It has a couple of other things on each side of the or. Referring to page 1112 of the brief, 508 of the case, thus the strictest scrutiny is appropriate when the basis for the mistrial is the unavailability of critical prosecution evidence or when there is reason to believe that the prosecutor is using superior resources, etc. Are those two statements inconsistent? Is Barthels incorrect in its statement because it is not using the same words on both sides of the or?
No, I really don't think so. I construe them as being similar in intent, you know, content, although the terminologies might be a little bit different, that whenever the state asks for a mistrial, the court has a responsibility to closely scrutinize it, the strictest scrutiny when it's an unavailable state witness. In terms of what that practically means, it means the court independently reviews the legal components of the claim to see whether it meets the legal standard of manifest necessity. And if to have a legal standard of such a nature requires some type of objective measure, in the context of that, like any Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment kind of claim, there will be factual findings made which reviewing courts will defer to, appropriately so, because the trial judge is sitting there. If the jury, trial judge says, the juror's mouth's dropped open when he made this remark, it seems to me the appellate court's bound to defer to that kind of observation.
Well, what we're talking about here, I suppose, let me see if I can frame the issues. The issue of what standard of review we should employ when the court makes a finding of manifest necessity. Is that a correct phrasing of the issue?
Yeah, and that's as close as you can get.
I'll tell you what I have concerns with, and I guess that's close to what the Court of Appeals says. The question we need to answer is whether, as a result of those remarks, the state would have been denied a fair proceeding before an impartial jury. Stated differently, did Carroll's reference to the warrants cause the jury to hear information so inappropriate that the jury became incurably tainted? And that last phraseology is what constitutes the manifest necessity. I don't know the answer. I mean, you've got Arizona versus Washington, which says, look, on one end you have it really, really, really heavy, and on the other end you have it light, 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 light. And then you and your opposing counsel both suggest there's stuff in between, that it all depends on the facts and circumstances of the individual case.
And I think that's the Supreme Court, recognize the difficulty, because there's such a myriad of problems that come up during the trial, it's hard to have a definitive standard that is clear-cut and applies to everything.
And
in some cases, there will be more factual findings that the trial judge can make than other situations.
So what are we supposed to do here? I mean, let's say the worst scenario is prosecution asks for mistrial, and it's based on prosecutorial misconduct. Well, then that's strict. No problem. I mean, that's really strict. That's really, 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 really de novo. have it on the other end. And so where are we to plug in? We like nice phrases. We like nice standards. We want to say, in this case, the standard of review is, and I'm not getting it from anyone. Yeah. I'm getting the standard of review is, it depends on the facts and circumstances of the case, and Washington and Barthels set forth the contours, the extremes, and we're someplace in between. And but you take the approach. Well, so help me with that. I won't share.
Okay. Well, this is interesting. In courts that have discussed Arizona versus Washington, and in effect, the decision itself, the analysis is as much analysis of process as it is of substance. And what I mean by that is, one, first of all, they're studying at a baseline that there was a clear impropriety that occurred, that this information couldn't come in, it was prejudicial, gasp, we start there. This case, of course, I challenge that premise, and I think the state sort of agreed that there seems to have been a mistake made on the underlying premise, whether there was a need for mistrial law. I don't know how you could have manifest necessity if there was no need for the mistrial because the evidence was admissible. But be that as it may, let's assume you have an error. The first step is to decide when the issue gets presented to the trial judge, objection, mistrial, this was improper. The first thing the judge's got to do is make a decision, was it improper? I mean, that's sort of the base starting point. Once you get there, Arizona versus Washington seems to have an outline of things the trial judge ought to do and what this judge did. First is, don't act hastily. Take your time and make a reasoned decision. give the parties a chance to argue their points so that the issue is fully fleshed out. And again, so we don't need to have a mistrial if one's not necessary. Carefully weigh the defendant's interest in having this tribunal decide the case. Are there alternatives? What are those alternatives? Are there jury instructions that could have been given to cure the error? Giving the parties a chance to identify what those instructions might be. And then making a decision on the record explaining why those options are inadequate. And that would be helpful for any reviewing court to have a spelled out rational process of what the decision making scheme was.
Why aren't you simply arguing? Just take the simplest erroneous exercise of discretion case. It's an erroneous exercise of discretion if the court gets the facts wrong or the law wrong. And in this case, the court got the law wrong, namely that this evidence was going to be admitted. Therefore, it was an erroneous exercise of discretion. There was not a manifest necessity for the mistrial. And the ends of public justice would be defeated by having a second trial when there's been an erroneous exercise of discretion.
Well, I mean, for Mr. Seifelt, erroneous exercise of discretion stands just fine, because I think under this record he should prevail. The difficulty is that's inadequate to protect the interest at stake. In theory, you could have a trial start out, defense counsel asks a question, state says, objection leading, motion for mistrial. The judge could be absolutely right on the law, but there's just no compelling reason to have a mistrial. Or objection hearsay, and the judge may be right that it's hearsay, but every error in the trial doesn't warrant a mistrial. And so the trial judge's ability to be right on an evidentiary matter doesn't foreclose a constitutional violation. That Arizona versus Washington requires more to be done by the trial judge. And again, to have a standard of manifest necessity, which places the bar very high before we're going to terminate the trial.
And the bar here is on the state. The bar that has to be overcome is on the state. The state has to overcome this bar. Is that right?
It's the state's, I think they call it their heavy burden to show the manifest necessity or high necessity. I mean, they didn't clear the hurdle. They didn't get off the ground to clear the hurdle in this case. So, in terms of them meeting their burden on this record,
what kind of opinion do you write under this? Well, it all depends. We can't make a decision. There's no bright rule. Is that the kind of opinion you write? And in this case, we say such and such.
Well, I think whether or not there was manifest necessity is ultimately a question of law. The findings of the trial court as to various factual matters are entitled to deference. But I think in terms of a decision being written, part of the benefit of decision would be to outline a procedure for a trial court to follow when confronted by a motion for mistrial filed by the state, that it's to treat the matter seriously, maybe sure to exercise a sound discretion, scrupulously honoring the defendant's right to double jeopardy protection, and I guess sort of outlining the steps I suggested earlier. First, you discern whether there is an error. Then you allow the parties to argue their points, allow the parties to argue alternatives to a mistrial, giving notice to the parties that you're contemplating a mistrial so that they can debate why that's appropriate or not. Carefully weighing the right to have the trial proceed to a finality, and articulating why alternatives to mistrial are inadequate. It seems to me it's as much process as it is substance, and because of the variety of circumstances, it's hard to have a hard and fast rule. I wish I could provide a clear-cut rule, but I don't think it's practical, frankly. Otherwise, I rely on my brief for the other issues raised in the case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Mr. Kloss?
Okay, I appreciate we're running a little late here. I would make the point.
I didn't understand.
Okay, I appreciate we're running a little bit late in time, so I'll just make my remarks brief. I would submit to the court that based on the law
and I'm looking at Arizona versus Washington State versus Barthels, there are just two appropriate standards of review: deferential review, strict scrutiny. Now, if there's some intermediate one, I can't suggest that to the court. But it seems to me that that's what those two cases are telling us.
Counsel, yes. By your earlier response to the Chief's comments, when she asked you what is the whole spectrum, you started out by responding, well, the greatest deference would be if the defendant asked for a mistrial. That response, to me, implied there were levels of deference by you responding that way. And now you're saying, no, there's no levels of deference. Which is it?
Let me clarify. I think I then proceeded, after talking myself through that, that really, when there's a waiver, that's really it's a question of waiver. If the defendant moves for a mistrial, he's waiving his double jeopardy. That's it. The court makes the finding of waiver has been made. I don't even see where deferential or strict scrutiny as a standard even comes in. Because if the court, this court can find that the record supports a waiver of double jeopardy by making a motion for a mistrial, that's the end of the issue. So when we're talking about deferential or strict scrutiny, I think we are talking about, really, when you get down to the final analysis, motions for mistrial made by the state.
I also want to clarify your position, counsel, with regard to whether or not this evidence is admissible, would have been admissible, would have properly been admissible. And the evidence I'm referring to is reference to the warrant. It appeared to me, in response to questions, you said that it may have come in, yet in your brief, at the top of page 16, you state, the state concedes that the warrant evidence in some form would probably have been admissible. What's your position? Are you conceding it probably would have come in, or are you saying you don't know if it would have come in?
I think the reservation that I have is, and looking at the probative value of this evidence as being so slight, that the trial court possibly could have just weighed and taken it out.
That's the 90403 argument.
Correct.
That you responded to. I didn't see that in your brief at all. I read your brief as it says on top of page 16. You can see that it's coming in, and I may be, you know, it's been a little bit since I've read your brief.
Correct.
But I don't recall 90403 even being referenced whatsoever.
Not specifically. That's correct.
Wasn't the trial judge obligated to go through the admissibility analysis before granting a mistrial in order to determine whether or not the jury had been tainted? How could he make a summary conclusion that this evidence tainted the jury without first addressing whether it would have been admitted?
I assume that the trial court in his own mind did so, but it's...
How can we make that assumption here?
Because
all he did was summarily conclude that...
Well, as I understand the trial court's position here, is the trial court ruled that the jury was being tainted by inadmissible evidence.
Well, as I read the trial court's decision, what there is of it is that he was offended that the defense attorney had contravened the pretrial in-chambers discussions, which were not memorialized on the record. And so I question whether or not there was an enforceable order in the first place. But assuming, as the Court of Appeals did, that there was an enforceable order that any evidence even coming close to this category of evidence had to be discussed ahead of time and rulings made on admissibility ahead of time before it was mentioned in opening statement, even assuming that such an order existed, that it was the violation of that order that precipitated the mistrial, not any conclusion on the part of the judge that this evidence was, in fact, inadmissible, because he didn't even address that.
Well, I guess all I can do in response to that is the trial court did rule, or did make several findings. It ruled, first of all, that no curative instruction could cure the or could cure the situation because the jury was tainted by the evidence.
But before you get to the need for a curative instruction, there has to be a finding that the evidence is inadmissible. Otherwise, there's no violation.
I agree. And the only thing I can suggest to the court, argue to the court, is that the trial court did do that. It just failed to make that exercise of discretion on the record. In other words, I think Justice Wilcox mentioned it before, he didn't go through the process and set this all out in the record in a way that makes it reviewable.
How can we conclude, even applying the most deferential standard of review, that that was a sound exercise of discretion within the meaning of Arizona?
Well, the case law says the states can attempt to convince the court that there is a reasonable basis for the trial court's ruling, even if it's not apparent on the record.
And the reasonable basis you're arguing now is 90403, which was not referenced in your brief.
Well, the court did. First of all, the brief, we said it may be admissible in some form, putting a limitation on scope and admissibility of the evidence. So I think there was a reservation there that this evidence in this particular form, in other words, that the jury is going to be informed that there are 15 outstanding warrants without any further explanation, was just going to come to the jury in that form and without any question and without any ruling on admissibility by the trial court. The trial court could definitely either have excluded the evidence or shaped the form in which it was presented to the jury in a way which did not prejudice the state. So that's the argument we have to make. Are there any further questions?
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Kloss. Thank you, Mr. Kloss, and thank you, Mr. Lang, for your arguments this morning on this troublesome double jeopardy issue. That concludes our argument in 01-1969 CR State v. Seafelt. We're going to take a few moments in recess so the students who wish to leave may leave and additional students may come.